This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, MIBiz senior writer Mark Sanchez recaps all of the back and forth so far in the attempt to acquire pharmaceutical company Perrigo. But first, as Governor Rick Snyder and leaders in the legislature start talking about fixing Michigan roads in the wake of voters rejecting a ballot proposal, some differences are emerging. The governor says he's willing to look at savings in other areas of the budget, but has also emphasized that generating the $1 billion or more needed for infrastructure will require some additional revenue. Republican leaders in the legislature seem resistant to a tax increase. We're going to talk about the differences within the Republican Party and the legislature in general with Western Michigan University political science professor Peter Wheelhauer. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Gordon.
So is this a very common Republican debate, the idea that if you want to get something done, you may have to compromise on some of your principles? And for Republicans, a big principle is not increasing taxes unless it's absolutely necessary.
Well, I think the notion in politics in general is if you want to get anything done, the nature of working in a legislature requires compromise. So you're always giving up to a certain extent on your principles. In this case, we're talking about the need to generate enough revenue to fix something that people universally agree needs to be fixed, that is our roads, but not having enough cash on hand to actually make that happen. The only solution seems to be coming up with the revenue because the costs are so high. That implies raising taxes. So the Republicans are really in a box, especially if they've made a commitment not to raise taxes as part of their party platforms or campaign promises, and now they're faced with a situation where they need the money.
Is the fact that there are business groups who are saying, look, we need better roads if we're going to have a vibrant economy in Michigan, does that give any political cover to someone who might be willing to then say, okay, I can vote for this increase in taxes or perhaps fees in order to have better roads so that therefore businesses can thrive?
I think that within the Republican Party, the business community does carry a lot of weight. On the other hand, the business community, when it comes to actually casting votes in an election, you know, they're only a small portion of the electorate. So the Republicans, as all parties have to do in different legislatures, have to manage this question of what is in the best interest of the state with what is going to give me political cover or is going to cost me at the ballot box. What can I justify? I think you could make the case that a small increase in taxes in a targeted way to generate enough revenue to fix the roads is very defensible. But it's clear that the effort to do so with the ballot measure from a few weeks ago was not adequate and not adequately sold to the public.
So Governor Snyder, if he's looking for some sort of a revenue increase, does he have to factor into that equation that he's going to need as many Democratic votes as he can get in both the House and Senate to make that work and then turn to his own party to get the rest?
I think it's very clear that if the governor wants to work with the legislature and get taxes through it, he has to have Democratic votes. There is a segment of Republicans who simply will not vote for a tax increase, period. And so the job of the speaker and the job of the governor is to come up with that handful of Republicans that are willing to vote for a tax increase, and then put that together and build a coalition with Democrats who are also willing to do that and are willing to hand the governor essentially a victory for the good of the state.
Is there an analogous issue for Democrats where it's very hard to get them to vote for X, even if it is at the end of the day the thing that leads to a compromise? We've seen, of course, Democrats oppose President Obama on trade authority. Is trade one of those issues where it's a flag that Democrats plant and say it's going to take a lot to move me off of this? An issue of principle, I guess.
Well, I think that this is a matter of internal politics within the party when we talk about the president. That's a very different dynamic than the kinds of things that we're facing here in this, at the state level. My general sense is that each governor is faced with a set of issues, and dealing with the political parties in the legislature requires navigating the specific issues that occur at that season of the state's history. So right now we're dealing with this roads issue. Last year, Indiana was dealing with this with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. In another state, in another year, they might be dealing with a big environmental disaster. So I think this varies from year to year, state to state. It's hard to predict in any coherent sense what the long-term issues are going to be. I do think that in this case, this question of the roads and their deterioration is going to be an ongoing perpetual problem until it gets fixed, until there's some kind of a compromise on both sides.
In the State House, Kevin Cotter has put forward the outline of a plan which would really not rely much on additional revenue. He says that he wants to find some pots of money, other parts of the budget. Governor Snyder's indicated that probably won't work. But let's look at the world for a moment through Kevin Cotter's lens. There's a pretty sizable number of Republicans in the House who, as you say, are not going to vote for a tax increase. So if you're Kevin Cotter and you assume that he wants to get something done, how tricky are those waters to navigate?
It seems to me that Speaker Carter's big problem is trying to work with his own party to build a coalition, and he's going to have to go across the aisle. I don't know exactly the number of votes that he'll need, but if it's a third or a half of the Republican caucus that's not willing to raise taxes, he really does have to find some Democratic votes. That makes for a very challenging position, especially in a legislature that has been kind of known to be fairly partisan over the last several years.
Kevin Cotter's had his own kind of internal battles. He banned Representative Cindy Gamrat of Plainwell from House Republican caucus meetings because of some posts that she put on Facebook, which he said shared internal, confidential type information, which should not have been made public. As we speak right now, she has not been readmitted to those meetings. Is it possible that Kevin Cotter was sending a bit of a message to rebellious type Republican representatives that he's there to get things done and that he's not interested in sort of petty squabbling and that sort of thing?
I think that he would say, I'm here to get things done and I'm not going to put up with petty squabbling. My sense is that from the other side, they're saying he is trying to maintain his own power as the head of the Republican Party in the legislature, and that means that he is not willing to work with people who are on the extreme end of the party. So as the speaker, he's got to manage this whole household. If you have a few people who are not willing to play by your rules, then he has to figure out how he's going to respond to that. It looks pretty clearly like he is playing hardball. As we know, he doesn't have very long as speaker. He has maybe 4 years at best as Speaker of the House. So he doesn't really have time to build careful, nuanced relationships with people who aren't on his side every step of the way. So I think it's pretty clear. He's playing hardball, trying to send the message, don't mess with me. We've just got to get stuff done. And if you're not going to play along by my rules, then I'm going to cut you off.
And is there some risk from that standpoint that, you know, the people who support Representative Gamrat say, hey, she went through a Republican primary and then was duly elected. Who is Kevin Cotter to say that she's not welcome at House Republican caucus meetings? I guess is there the danger of perhaps stirring up other people who then see him as part of the establishment and part of the problem?
I think within the legislators themselves, it could cut both ways. If you have a large number of people who are sympathetic to Cindy Gamrat's position and wish that they had done what she had done, then what Cotter did probably would scare them off from taking that, because that's a pretty big hit. If you're trying to work within your own party to be a voice for a minority position within the majority party, and all of a sudden you no longer have a voice in the meetings, then if you find that happens to somebody else, you don't want that to happen to you. And you're going to keep your mouth shut and you're going to play along a little bit more cooperatively. If he continues to work in a very hyper-partisan way, in which he's taking the very hard line with an increasing number of his own members, then he starts to have real problems in terms of just getting business done. If it's only a few members, that's not really a problem for him. The more and more members that get angry about that and get frustrated by that and start to act on that, the harder time he's going to have to manage his caucus.
Is that in part because he does have a pretty big majority in the House, that if there's a few people who decide not to vote with him, simply because there's a dispute over party leadership and those sort of things, that he can live with that because he doesn't really have to start going to the other side, to the Democrats for votes, until he loses a sizable number of Republicans.
Exactly. In terms of figuring out how to pass a bill, when you look at what he needs to pass a bill, he needs 50% plus one. That's how many votes he needs. And with a large majority in the House for the Republican Party, he's got some flexibility. He can sacrifice a few.
Does this issue of Rhodes perhaps set the table for what Governor Snyder may be dealing with for most of his second term, that there will be issues where he is on the opposite side from the legislature in his own party, the legislative leaders, or at least the majority of Republican lawmakers, issues such as prevailing wage, where he has said that he's opposed to repealing it and Republicans in the legislature are moving ahead on that. He has said that he wants any religious freedom bill, which is being debated to include protections against discrimination for gays and lesbians. It's not clear if that's ever going to make it through the legislature in that form. Could this be sort of normal for the next couple years, that Governor Snyder is having to work with a lot of Democrats and then some of the Republicans in his own party to get what he wants?
I think this is clearly the case, because when Rick Snyder was nominated to be the Republican nominee for governor, if you recall that election, he had a group of five pretty conservative competitors and Rick Snyder, who kind of pulled up the middle. And he basically won because the conservatives all split the vote. So now what happens with Rick Snyder's ideological position? We all know he is not a strident conservative. He's not a lifetime politician. He's a businessman, and he thinks in a very pragmatic way about politics. For good or ill, that's the lens through which he views Michigan politics and his job as governor, and he's made that very clear over the years. So then when he's faced with a legislature who has a much more overtly political tack, much more overtly political and party-oriented prism through which they view the world, he's got to manage that as well. So I think that he's positioned well to compromise with the Republicans and the Democrats in the legislature to get things done that he relentlessly sees as good for the state. But that's going to tick off some people on the right, and he's going to have some people on the far left who aren't going to agree with it either. What he needs to find is a governing majority in the middle within both chambers of the legislature.
And is his position to accomplish that helped by the fact that, one, he is in his second term, he can't run for another one as governor, and he is now ruled out running for the White House, so he will not be off to New Hampshire and Iowa, presumably, for long stretches of time? I mean, does that put him in a better position to be that sort of mediator?
I think the fact that he can't run for a third term, in this case, works to his advantage. In this sense that he can work with both parties across the aisle to get things done, and nobody really views that with suspicion as he's trying to leverage those outcomes to build a legacy to launch himself to the next political phase, especially at least in the short term. So I think that that works to his advantage. On the other hand, as with any governor who's in the last 2 years of his term, he's a lame duck. And so the problem that he's going to face is a sense that he doesn't have any future leverage or things that he can promise to people down the road in order to work with him. So his tools for getting things done are more constrained, but he's also freed up in terms of not having to be beholden to people over a long period of time.
Does that make the period between now and, say, the 2016 election, which is sort of the midterm for a governor, yep, they'll be electing new members to the state house then, does that make this stretch of time more important for him, perhaps the time when he can really get things done?
I think what he would argue is that it's always time to get things done.
And
that I think that he probably wouldn't look necessarily to the political calendar the way that pundits and junkies might. He's got to face the reality of the pressures that people who need to be reelected are facing. He's got to deal with that. It's just the realistic fact of dealing with the legislature. But I think that he genuinely has the opportunity to work across the aisle to get things done. And I think that's what we should expect to see.
Western Michigan University political science professor Peter Wielhauer, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
You can find links with more about proposals to fund road repair in Michigan at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Perrigo has received multiple offers from Mylan NV, which wants to acquire the producer of over-the-counter medication. At the same time, Perrigo, which still has most of its main corporate offices in Allegan, despite being officially headquartered in Ireland, is also in the market to buy other companies. Mark Sanchez is senior writer for MIBiz, and he has been covering this story. Mark Sanchez, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So there have been three offers made by Mylan NV to acquire Perrigo. What makes Perrigo attractive from the standpoint of Mylan?
A number of things. First, it's a pretty well-run corporation. It has a logistics system that's amazing in its ability to distribute its product all over the world. It's been growing very well. It's made numerous acquisitions in the last number of years that have driven growth. It's just beginning to get into the European market, where it bought a company called Omega Pharmaceuticals recently, spent about $4.5 billion there. Omega is a major producer of OTC, over-the-counter products in Europe. And OTC, these are basically your store brand medications you buy at Meijer, Walgreens, Walmart, cold and flu ointment, allergy medication, things along those lines. And Perrigo is a major, major player in this market. It really has a sizable global market share. You also look at it that Mylan really is more of a pharmaceutical maker, generic drug. And Perrigo does some generics as well. Mylan has been wanting to get into this OTC market. Earlier this year, it bought the foreign operations of Abbott Laboratories in Europe. And that brought Mylan into the OTC market. And it really sees acquiring Perrigo as kind of a complementary acquisition that can give it a good base, a good foothold into the global market for OTC medications.
So these offers have been on the table now, three separate ones, and Perrigo keeps saying no. Why is Perrigo not taking these offers apparently to heart, or is not willing to consider at this point selling?
A couple of reasons. Number one, Perrigo, in a conference call and presentation to investors last week, really laid out a strategy where it believes it's in a good position to grow on its own as a standalone business. It's made a number of acquisitions over the years, and two major acquisitions, one about a year and a half ago, was called Elon Corporation over in Europe, and then this Omega Pharmaceuticals acquisition really positions the company to grow very well overseas and in the foreign markets. At the same time, Perrigo says it's positioned to grow about 5 to 10% on its own in the coming years, and it can really boost sales at a pretty decent rate. But also, we can then accelerate sales with doing what Chairman and CEO Joe Papa calls bolt-on acquisitions. These are kind of adjacent product categories, areas where it makes sense to get into. And we can grow sales that way. At least that's what the folks at Perrigo are saying. And this really has a strategy predicated on we're filling a truck with our products. We're sending this truck to Walmart, Walgreens, wherever. Hey, let's get into another product category. We can put another pallet of product on that truck. We have the distribution channel, the logistics network. We can send more product to that particular store and that particular customer. And for all of that, Perrigo just seems it's in a good position to go on its own. And you also hear that line, Mylan has undervalued Perrigo. It just Perrigo sees more value in itself than what Mylan has put on the table.
Perrigo CEO Joe Papa has said that the company's directors would have to consider selling, in his words, at some point. But he also said, we're not anywhere close to that. Has anyone from Perrigo sent any sort of signal? Obviously, whenever someone like Joe Papa talks about this, he's got to be careful about what he says and pick his message pretty carefully. But has anybody from Perrigo indicated at what point they would be getting close to considering?
No, and there's some real strict SEC regulations on communications that come out of a company and what he can say publicly, what he cannot say publicly. Is it material information if he's having a conversation with investors? Does that conversation, the subject matter, does that meet the threshold as material information, and then do you have to disclose that to the public? In the presentations, one was an earnings call a few weeks after this first came out, and then there was an investor presentation last week. In that presentation last week, Joe Papa did say, yes, there is a number that we will have to consider this. Remember, directors have a fiduciary responsibility to shareholders to get the best shareholder value. If Miley were to put so much money on the table in such a compelling offer, in time, the board would have to give that serious consideration. Nobody's indicating where that number's at, what is that threshold, how much involved. But under simple business principles and that fiduciary responsibility, yes, at some point in time, if that number creeps up further, Perrigo would have to take an offer and seriously consider it.
And just to spell that out a little bit, we're talking here not necessarily what Joe Papa would like to do as CEO of the company or the board of directors would want to do, but simply that they have to look at, can they get a really good deal for their shareholders? And if the price is X, then they would be negligent in their duty to their shareholders if they didn't at least consider it.
Yeah, you have to, as a board and board of directors, as a director, you have to act in the best interest of your shareholders. You are there to protect their interest. At what point are you looking out for the interest of the company, or at what point are you looking out for the interest of the shareholders? One likes to believe that those interests are one and the same. Although, when companies get this big as Mylan and Perrigo are, you have a lot of institutional shareholders. I think Perrigo is 95% owned by institutional shareholders. These are your large investment funds across the world, across America. And, you know, they're worried about, their concern is, where's their value, their earnings out of their investment and their return on their investment. So there is some pressure there. If some shareholders think that this is a compelling offer, if Mylan raises it and keeps going up, that yes, they need to at least give some serious consideration to that.
Mylan has indicated that they plan to continue pursuing an acquisition of Perrigo. What options do the top officials at Mylan have beyond just simply boosting their offer price?
Well, they intend, what they put forward last week is they intend to make a tender offer. First, Mylan sometime probably by late summer, we'll see Mylan have a shareholder meeting and get approval from its shareholders to go forward with this offer and to make this formal tender offer to Perrigo shareholders. You can bet right now there are a lot of conversations going on, reaching out to shareholders again. It's not just individuals that own these companies. These are institutions and large organizations and funds that hold these shares. So there's outreach going on. There's communication going on. Ultimately, if Mylan goes forward and makes this tender offer, it could start kind of a little bit of a battle for the control of the company, and then shareholders have to decide, do I like this offer? Do I indeed sell my shares to Mylan? Ultimately, how it plays out is Mylan does not get enough shares or is able to acquire enough shares to take control of the company.
Is this what you're describing there? Is that getting close to what we would call a hostile takeover of Perrigo, if that's what they were going to try?
Yeah, pretty much. Once that tender offer is filed and goes forward, now you're talking about, you know, there's some technical issues on what you consider a hostile takeover, but in a sense, it's an unsolicited offer. It's going against management's wishes, board wishes. From that colloquial sense, yeah, that'd be a proper way to describe it.
Interestingly enough, Mylan is itself the subject of an unsolicited offer from a company that wants to acquire them. Does this create some sort of a tough spot for Mylan to be in if they're trying to acquire Perrigo at the same time someone else is trying to buy them?
Now, there's a lot of research analysts, brokers, or analysts who think this is exactly why Mylan wants to buy Perrigo. Teva Pharmaceuticals in Israel wants to buy Mylan. And this is the way that industry is going, the pharmaceutical industry across the globe. Everybody wants to get bigger, optimize costs, have more leverage, have more pricing power. And everybody wants to grow. So one way to do that is to consolidate. So Teva wants to buy Mylan, and it's believed that Mylan is kind of trying to get a hedge against Teva by making this offer to Perrigo. Teva predicates its offer to Mylan on the Perrigo deal not going through, and Teva has promised to start a tender offer for Mylan shares. So that's kind of adding to some of the drama to all this that makes it kind of a fascinating scenario. And in my years of running business around this region, I don't recall any particular scenario where we've seen a local, homegrown, iconic corporation involved in this type of situation. We've seen buyouts of large homegrown corporations. The one that comes to mind mostly is the Pharmacia Upjohn Pfizer deal in Kalamazoo years ago. We see how that ended up. But I don't recall any situation where we've seen this unsolicited outside offer coming to our local corporation that is intent on buying that company.
Is there some way in which dominoes would start falling here? In other words, if one of these acquisitions were to happen, it could either trigger another acquisition or perhaps shut the door on any further purchases going forward.
Yeah, you know, that's something I'm not sure I can really speculate on, but often in M&A circles, when you see mergers and acquisitions in an industry, especially when you see a lot of activity, one acquisition will start conversations in the boardroom of a competitor or a rival company. Okay, this company, our rival, our competitor made this move. Do we need to make a move to counter that? You know, if your competitor just picked up X capability that gives them a competitive advantage over you, you may need to counterpunch and then pursue your own strategy. And if that strategy is acquisition, then you need to pursue it.
Is there any sense yet what all of this could mean in the town of Allegan, where Perrigo still has a large presence? Obviously, we'd have to know exactly what the terms are of some sort of purchase if it ultimately happens. But is there good reason for people in Allegan to be just a little bit nervous these days?
Boy, if I were the mayor of Allegan or doing economic development in Allegan, I'm certainly paying attention to this. Mylan has said it believes this deal could generate $800 million in synergies, its word. That money and those costs have to come from somewhere. You know, Perrigo has been in Allegan for a long time, and by all accounts, it's a pretty good corporate citizen down there. And now we're seeing an outside company wanting to buy and take control of our hometown company. If you're from Allegan and that's your perspective. And I've talked to some folks and they say these types of deals don't always have a great history of working out. I'm reminded of, obviously, of the Upjohn Pharmacia Pfizer deal and how that played out over a number of years in Kalamazoo. I recall a company in Zealand many years ago, about 15 years ago, Bat, that made garment hangers. It was bought out by a competitor who came in and just basically closed all the factories in Zealand. There's about 500 to 600 people who were put out of work in that. So those are a couple of worst-case scenarios that come to mind, and they didn't work out too well for the hometown, although the folks in Kalamazoo were able to put together a plan, and it's worked out fairly well for Kalamazoo out of the Pfizer cuts there, as well as in Ann Arbor. So, yeah, if I'm in Allegan right now and I hold one of those positions in Allegan, I'm paying attention to this, maybe with a little bit of concern about what the future holds.
Mark, is there any sort of timeline here where we can say that the next step is likely to come at a certain date and will tell us a little more about how this is going to play out?
Yeah, I don't know if anybody's really sure how it's going to play out at this point, but in the investor presentation last week, Joe Papa indicated, based on his understanding of Irish takeover rules, and remember, Perrigo is now domiciled in Dublin, Ireland, so the rules there are a little different than the rules in America. But by his explanation, he anticipates Mylan will have to make this offer by September 14th. So we'll see this play out over the summer. We could see moves and counter moves. And I'm not quite sure. I don't think anybody's really sure exactly how it will play out. But it's going to be interesting to watch.
Mark Sanchez, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Mark Sanchez is senior writer for MI Biz. You can find links to his stories on Mylan's attempts to take over Perrigo at WMUK.org. West Southwest airs Mondays and Thursdays. It can be heard at 9:30 those mornings with a repeat at 3:30 in the afternoon. You can always find past programs and links with more information at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.